We're going to read from James chapter 4. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You desire but do not have, so you kill. You covet, so you cannot get what you want, so you quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures. Sorry, I've jumped before myself. So to chapter verse 13. Now listen, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes. All such boasting is evil. If anyone then knows the good they ought to do and doesn't do it, it is sin for them. Now listen, you rich people, weep and wail because of the misery that is coming on you. Your wealth has rotted and moths have eaten your clothes. Your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will testify against you and eat your flesh like fire. You have hoarded wealth in the last days. Look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourself in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who was not opposing you. Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door. Brothers and sisters, as an example of patience in the face of suffering, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. As you know, we count as blessed those who have persevered. You have heard of Job's perseverance and have seen what the Lord finally brought about. The Lord is full of compassion and mercy. Above all, my brothers and sisters, do not swear, not by heaven or by earth or by anything else. All you need to say is a simple yes or no. Otherwise, you will be condemned.
It was Thomas Edison who said, apparently, genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. Thomas Edison is described as perhaps America's greatest inventor. I didn't know this, but by the end of his life, he had over 1,000 patents in his name for his inventions. Incredible. Said he worked an average of 18 hours a day, and he practiced Herculean patience, going over experiments again and again and again until he got them right, and they worked. Of course, perhaps his most famous invention was the electric light bulb. But the best example, I think, of his perseverance is his invention of the alkaline storage battery. He writes that it became a reality after over 10,000 failed experiments. Amazing. And Edison wrote, our greatest weakness lies in giving up. Our greatest weakness lies in giving up. The most certain way to succeed is always to try just one more time. Well, he's a great example of perseverance. I think that phrase, our greatest weakness lies in giving up, it really struck me as I read that saying preparing for this sermon this morning. And if perseverance is an important quality in life in general, which it is, it's certainly a very important aspect, isn't it, of the spiritual life, the life of the Christian. And so this morning we're thinking about a faith that perseveres. You've asked me to look at these strange sort of chapters and divisions here in James. I'm sure you've noticed that before in your series. He writes sometimes almost disjointedly. And so this morning we're looking at the end of chapter 4 and the beginning of chapter 5. And we're thinking about a faith that perseveres. What are the characteristics of a faith that perseveres? What's the secret of persevering faith? We've just been enjoying, haven't we? We saw in Athens as well, the athletics, the world championship from London last few weeks or so. You ask the athletes taking part in those events, what is more important? How well you start or how well you finish? And I'm sure they'll tell you, well, it's the finishing, that's the most important thing. You can start really well. You can get off to a flying start in a race. But if you can't keep it up, then you're not going to finish well. Now, what's the secret of running a race successfully? How do you persevere into the end? Well, yes, you have to pace yourself, but you're thinking about the finishing. You're thinking about that last lap, and that great burst of speed, perhaps, if you're Mo Farah. Or you're thinking about that last 10 or 15 meters in a dash. You're thinking about the finishing tape. Even if you started badly and you stumbled, you have to put that behind you. And you have to focus now on the rest of the race and finishing well, persevering. And really that's exactly the focus that we find in our passage this morning that Sarah read to us from James' letter. He's encouraging his readers to keep focused on the future. And in particular to focus on a Christ-shaped future, on Jesus. Let me just read to you again what he said in chapter 5, verses 7 and 9. He says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. That's what it would be to focus on. Be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble against one another, brothers and sisters, or you'll be judged, and the judge is standing at the door. And another Hebrew, another Jewish writer, the writer to the Hebrews, he says exactly the same thing, doesn't he? You know the verses. Chapter 12, verse 1 of the Hebrews, he says, let us run with perseverance the race that's marked out for us. How? Fixing our eyes on Jesus. So, I think what James gives us here in this passage, if we're thinking of this theme of perseverance, are practical ways in which that focus on Jesus is worked out in the Christian life. Practical ways in which persevering faith, looking to Jesus, can be seen in our everyday lives. And so I'm going to suggest there's three here. First way, verses 13 to 17 of that fourth chapter. Faith that perseveres is seen in our planning. Faith that perseveres is seen in our planning. If we're going to persevere in the Christian life, if we're going to finish well, then what James is saying is that the will of God should be the focus of all our plans. James warning those in the church that he's writing to, those who are living their daily lives, day by day, as though they may pay lip service to God, but basically they're in control of their destiny, of everything they do and decide. And he says, such an attitude is arrogant and proud. Listen, he says, you who say, today or tomorrow, we will go to this city or that city and spend a year there and carry on business and make money. Why, you do not even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. As it is, you boast in your arrogant schemes, and all such boasting is evil. Strong language, isn't it? Why is it evil? Why is it arrogant and proud to speak and think and act like that? Well, you see, I think these people, and we presume they are professing Christians, but they won't accept their ignorance. They won't accept their ignorance. He says, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. He's warning them. Remember, your knowledge is limited. It's finite. You don't know everything. You're not God, and you cannot presume on tomorrow. I mean, that's so true, isn't it? Practically, just think about it. There's not one of us in this room this morning whose tomorrow cannot be so radically changed from what we're expecting now. Just in a moment. Just the buzzing of your mobile phone and a message which could completely change everything that you've planned tomorrow. Maybe today. All your plans are abandoned because of that message. Something's happened. Something's cropped up. And so says James, we should live our lives in humble recognition that we don't know. We can't presume. Only God knows, everything. Only God knows what tomorrow holds for you and for me. And we must accept that sort of level of ignorance. So then you say, well, how can we live like that? Is it wrong to plan anything? Well, no, of course it's not wrong to plan. The Apostle Paul planned. That's why his life was so productive. He was a planner, but he was well aware of his own ignorance and his own finiteness, and he submitted all his planning to the will of God. Let me just give you a few examples. If you study the Acts of the Apostles and the letters of Paul, you find this humble planning but humble attitude in the great apostle. I've looked at, well, it's more times, but four times we read in his writings that he was making plans, and Paul conditioned all his plans with that, if it is God's will. 1 Corinthians 4:19 says to the Corinthians, I will come to you very soon if the Lord is willing. 1 Corinthians 16:7, I hope to spend some time with you if the Lord permits. Romans 1:10, I pray that now at last, by God's will, the way may be open for me to come to you. Acts 18:21, as he leaves the leaders from Ephesus, he says, I will come back if it is God's will. Four times at least. He's making plans, but he's submitting them to God's will. Three times in those occasions, God says yes. He went back and visited and saw them again. But the last time, Ephesus, he never made it back. And Paul was content to submit his plans to the will of God. He's praying according to the will of the Lord. And all James is saying simply is this: let all your plans and all your ventures and all your hopeful schemes be conditioned by if God wills. Acknowledge that you're ignorant. And God alone knows all things. And he knows the future. Another aspect of this arrogance or this pride that James is criticizing here is that he says people won't accept their frailty. They don't accept their ignorance. They don't accept their frailty. What is your life? He asks them. You're a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Your life is just like a puff of smoke. It's nothing really. How short and fleeting and how soon gone and done with. It's true, isn't it? Because the older you get, the more you realize that. You take out the family photo album or you look at sometime, when you're cleaning out, you look at these old home videos that you made, and there's mum and dad or there's grandma and grandpa. They're so full of energy and life, and they're laughing and they're playing and they're talking and they're kissing and embracing. But now they've gone. Those voices are silent. It just seems like yesterday. They were with us. They spoke. They played and they enjoyed life with us. You look at their photograph and it's almost as though their faded photograph, those silent lips, they're just crying out to us, our life was a vapor. We've gone. Just a mist, a smoke. It's over. Friends, that's you and me. It's not just the guys in the photograph. Our lives are so short, frail, and soon we'll be gone. And so James says, live your life and make your plans, humbly acknowledging your frailty, if God wills. Acknowledge the tentative, the provisional nature of all your plans. Submit everything to the plan and the purposes and the providence of God, who alone is eternal and unchanging. It's so easy for us, isn't it, to be deceived. Friends, every day you live is a gift from God. And it's not guaranteed. It's a gift from God. You don't get another day by chance. You don't get another day by human right. You don't get another day by courtesy of Mother Nature or whoever. You get another day by the sovereign will and mercy of God. And our lives, our times are in his hands. And you see, that's really what's at the heart of this criticism of arrogance and pride by James. These people who speak like this, even if they're professing Christians, ultimately they're not accepting their dependence upon God. They don't accept their ignorance, they don't accept their frailty, they don't accept their total dependence upon God. They may call themselves Christians. James is speaking presumably to members of his congregation here in this letter. But what is in their hearts is seen in the practical outworking of their plans and their daily lives. They are living their lives day to day, practically independent of God. They're making their plans, they're building their houses, they're making their homes, they're running their businesses, they're furthering their careers, they're making their money, and practically, God doesn't really come into it. There's no real consideration for the will of God. James says, listen, plan. Yes, of course, plan. But plan humbly, acknowledging your ignorance, plan aware of your frailty, plan in complete dependence upon God, upon his purposes and his plans and his power. James urges to have a faith that perseveres through all the changing scenes of life, its troubles and its joys, because it's a faith that is Jesus-centered, God-centered. It makes God's will the focus of all our plans. And when planning, we recognize that, yeah, maybe our plans don't coincide with his own plans. And we submit humbly to the perfect will of God. We acknowledge his sovereignty over our lives. It's a planning that says, I will do this or that if God wills. And we mean it. Not just, well, God willing or the creek don't rise. If God wills. That if is vital. It is really vital in our Christian mentality. We've got to plan with that if in mind. And of course, the if is not it's not an if of doubt. It's not an if of fear of God. No, it's the if of a faith that is confident in the kindness and the goodness and the sovereignty of our Heavenly Father. If he wills. Because whatever he wills is going to be the best. So says James. That's the sort of faith that will persevere. It's seen in our planning. But then I think another thing he says here, and now we're into chapter 5 and verses 1 to 6. Faith that perseveres is seen in our priorities. Planning and our priorities. And the priority that James really focuses on here is wealth. It's money, possessions. Now, I don't know what you thought when Sarah was reading those verses. In some ways, these are very difficult verses to understand, aren't they? Scholars ask, who is James really speaking to here in these very cutting and critical verses about these rich people? Is he still addressing people in the church? Rich individuals? Landowners, perhaps, who worship side by side with poorer church members? Or maybe some scholars think that James is being more Hebraic, he's being more prophetic, like the Hebrew prophets, and he's just speaking out now generally about God's concern for peace and justice and righteousness. Which is it? Well, answer is we can't be sure. But basically, personally, I see no reason to presume that he isn't speaking still to the people he's just been addressing in chapter 4. The people who've been making their plans and doing their business and getting wealth without any concern for God. They go about their daily work without any real consideration for God in their plans and in their calculations. I think it's convenient, actually, for us. It's a nice way out for us if we presume, well, now at this point he's not speaking to church members. He's speaking prophetically to people who are outside. We can quietly excuse ourselves, can't we, from these rather cutting comments about riches and so on. Because, well, we say, well, after all, we're not rich, really, are we? You know, we're not rich like those guys. Friends, we are rich. The truth is, we are very rich. When compared with the rest of the world. You know the statistics, I'm sure. Don't necessarily want me to rehearse them all, but if you have any money saved, so in other words, you have more than just today's money, any money saved, if you have more than about 3 or 4 changes of clothes, if you live in your own home, if you own any sort of transport, you're in the top 5% of the world's wealthy. And I presume that's probably all of us. Or put it another way, 1 in 10 people in our world exist on less than £1.50 a day. 1 in 10, $2 a day. Friends, we're rich. Another staggering statistic that I read on an Oxfam website just a few weeks ago. I had to read it twice. 8 men, and they are all men, though that's not a sexist remark, but 8 men in this world have the same combined wealth as 3.6 billion of the poorest people in this world. In other words, 8 people have the same wealth as 50% of the world's poorest population. Friends, that's injustice. That's inequality of an extreme and, I would suggest, unacceptable nature. I don't want to get into politics now, but whatever your politics, surely you can't read the Bible as a Christian or listen to the parables of Jesus and listen to the warnings of the New Testament and think that God is not concerned about the poor and therefore has a lot to say to us who are rich in our attitudes, in our priorities. In fact, Jesus spoke about wealth and possessions as much as he did about heaven and hell in his parables. Why is that? Did he say that money is evil, that wealth is bad? No, he did not. But he did warn us that there's something strangely deceitful about riches, about wealth, that can so easily become the enemy of our faith, of our discipleship, of really following Jesus. That's why I think he mentions here just three things that apply to us all, whatever our bank balance, however small or large that might be. First of all, he warns us about hoarding wealth. That's the thing he says here in verse 3. You have hoarded your wealth in these last days. Now again, I don't think James means we shouldn't plan financially. Of course we should, that's wise. But there's a difference between saving and hoarding. And the difference, I suppose, is in the attitude of our hearts. And then that translates into our actions. Hoarding things speaks of greed. And the Bible roundly condemns on numerous occasions greed. Though of course we hardly ever hear a sermon about that in our nice comfortable middle class churches, greed. But that's the truth, hoarding. Hoarding is defined, I looked it up, as the excessive acquisition of possession or wealth with a failure to use them or disperse them. You just keep it. And you just get more and more. It's basically getting as much as you can and keeping it. It's the attitude that says, well, I've got this, it's all mine, and so I can do with it as I please. It's wealth without any thought for God, and sometimes without any thought for others either. You see, hoarding, behind hoarding, is the sin of greed in general, or for Christians, it's the sin of faithlessness. Because it's a failure to trust God for our needs. So we think we have to hoard excessively. And that's why the Bible warns us so often of the danger of wealth. That it can choke faith. Remember Jesus in the parables of the soils. Matthew 13:22. He says the seed falling among the thorns refers to someone who hears the word. Help, joyful, great. But the worries of this life and the deceitfulness of wealth choke the word and make it unfruitful. The deceitfulness of wealth. That's the point about deceit, isn't it? We don't realize it. And then there's another important principle here, James says. How you get your wealth. There's a warning against stealing wealth. Verse 4, look, the wages you failed to pay the workers who mowed your fields are crying out against you. The cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord Almighty. So, God is not only concerned with how much we've got and how we use it, hoarding, but he's also concerned with how much we've got and how we got it. How did you become wealthy? That matters to God. So as Christians, we should not be involved in any dishonest or unfair or unjust way of making money or even supporting those who do. We should not be making money at the expense of other people and making other people poor. And finally, in this section on our attitude to wealth, our priorities, here's the clearest warning, I think, of all. It's in verse 5, and it applies to us all, again, no matter how much or little we have. You have lived on earth in luxury and self-indulgence. You have fattened yourselves in the day of slaughter. You have condemned and murdered the innocent one who is not opposing you. What's this? Well, I think this is a warning against the decadence of wealth. The decadence of wealth. It's a warning against self-indulgence, luxurious living, with little regard for those who have not and the poor. In fact, basically James is saying your lifestyle practically condemns them and murders them because you live indifferent to their needs. You don't care. And meanwhile? Well, meanwhile, faith in God just shrivels up inside you, doesn't it? It goes to nothing. Because that's no longer your priority. Life is no longer motivated by godly priorities. but it's motivated by the pursuit of happiness and pleasure and leisure and so on. And a relationship with Jesus Christ and the concerns of his kingdom, they no longer count really. The priority of seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness, it no longer applies. The deceitfulness of wealth. Your treasure, practically, your treasure is here and now. And where your treasure is, there is your heart also. So that's why I think, finally, James says that persevering faith, faith that perseveres, is going to be seen in our patient endurance, in our patience. In our planning, in our priorities, putting first God's kingdom, but then in our patience, as we see it through to the end. You see, Christian patience isn't just resignation. It's not like fatalism. It's not just grinning and bearing whatever comes your way. No, Christian faith is a positive attitude because we're waiting for something magnificent. We're patiently waiting for something that is glorious. There's something so much bigger, so much more significant on the horizon for us than even the biggest concern of this earthly life that we face. What does James say in verse 7? Be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop, patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. So says James, be patient. Be patient like the farmer who is looking forward to a harvest. Be patient like the prophets, he says, who spoke of and anticipated Jesus, the Messiah's first coming. Now we're to be patient, waiting for his second coming. Be patient, he says, like Job. Why does he mention Job? Well, because of all his suffering, despite all his suffering, many things in his life that he wouldn't have chosen. He submitted to God's will. And he says, we have seen what the Lord finally brought about for Job. You see, the focus is on the future. Patiently waiting for the Lord's coming. There's a glorious end in sight. And so in a way, we're back to where we started at the beginning, aren't we? Faith that perseveres keeps its eyes on Jesus. Looking unto Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. So James says, you too be patient, stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near. The judge is standing at the door. And those rich, he says, who fattened themselves on their hoarded wealth, actually have only fattened themselves for the day of their own slaughter, when the judge will come and he'll execute justice and righteousness against the oppressors, when all their wealth will count for nothing because they're not rich towards God. You see, James calls us to patience, endurance, because he knows that the Christian life is a life of process and growth, and that requires patience. James knows that you don't become like Jesus overnight. Well, you can have wonderful experiences, and we ask for God's experience in his Holy Spirit, but James knows there's not just one definitive experience that will last for 15 or 20 minutes, and then that will so reorientate your life forever that you'll never have another struggle in your life, you'll never have any temptations, you'll never fall. No, that's not the reality of the Christian life. It's persevering faith through thick and thin. Our life is a process of growth in holiness and patient endurance. You don't drift or stumble into holiness. You grow into holiness. It's a process of patient endurance, and it can only be done if we have that proper focus on the coming of Jesus, as that reality bears into our lives. And persevering faith always keeps its focus on Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith. And faith that perseveres submits to the will of God. It takes the priorities of the kingdom of God. And it trusts patiently in the purposes of God, waiting that great day, the coming of our great judge and savior, Jesus Christ. Friends, someone has said, life is short, death is sure, sin the cause, Christ the cure. Live for self, you live in vain. Live for Christ, you live again. Well, may God ever give us such persevering faith by his grace.